I'm Jonna Kaplan, a writer, traveler, and I run the site thesizeofconnecticut.com.
I'm Carrie Provost, writer, photographer, and general troublemaker, and you're listening to Going Steady,
a podcast about exploring places in the land of steady habits and beyond.
On this episode, we'll be talking about the Connecticut Wine Trail, fall activities, water ferries, and whether or not the abundance of technology cheapens the travel experience. And we took a field trip to Saltwater Farm Vineyard in Stonington before recording this episode.
I'll start with a disclaimer that my wine drinking tends to be very lowbrow. Rosé out of a can, buy the cheap box wine, drink it in the park. But I am slowly starting to develop more of a appreciation for finer things sitting in real furniture.
And I'm also, I guess I would prefer to say, non-judgmental about wine. I do buy the bottles, not the boxes and cans, but I do buy the $6 bottles of wine, and I like a lot of them just fine, although I am quite picky about taste, so if that counts for anything. However, I have been to a number of Connecticut vineyards / wineries. I'm just going to use those two terms interchangeably, and, you know, if that's wrong, just let me know. Most of the ones that I've been to are in the southeastern corner of the state or the northwestern corner. And in general, most of the stops on the Connecticut Wine Trail are in the east or west of the state. There are a couple in the center, but not as many as in the east or west. The Connecticut Wine Trail, if you're listening to this and you've never really experienced it, which I hadn't until a few years ago when I wrote an article about the southeastern portion of the trail, it's actually been in existence since 1988, which I didn't know because I'd never heard of it. Growing up, I guess my parents weren't really the wine tasting sort. That seemed quite fancy to me until I went to my first one, but it's actually not at all fancy. Anyone can go, you know, you can wear jeans. It's a casual activity, really. So the Wine Trail, which their website is ctwine.com and we'll link to it, there's about 25 vineyards on there. And that's not the total number of vineyards in the state. There are more. These are just the ones that are part of this government-approved little program. And they have, you know, they do a wine festival every summer in Goshen, which I've never been to, which looks a little fancy, but I'm not quite sure since I've never been. They do a passport program from spring through fall where you get your little passport and you get it stamped every time you go to one. It really entices you to go to as many as you can fit in. I will say that. I only did it 1 year.
I saw some of the prizes. Earrings or like a trip for two to Spain.
Right. Yeah, I think the top prize is, or sometimes is, like a trip to Europe. Yeah, so they're pretty nice. But it's just kind of one of those things where you don't even care about the prize. You just want to get the little stamp. And the individual vineyards also have a lot of, it's not just tastings, they also do tours. Many of them sell food to like varying degrees, but you know, some cheese and crackers and things like that. They have live music often, they have events. Of course, you can rent them for private events like weddings, but they also sometimes host, you know, larger events. You can also go there and, like we did today, treat it almost like a restaurant or bar. You just order a glass of wine or a bottle of wine and you just sit in this stunning natural setting and look out over the vineyard. As much as I like a glass of wine, like most people, the draw for vineyards for me is really the atmosphere, because we really have some beautiful settings in this state, and that goes all the way from like Saltwater Farm, where we went today. It's right on the coast. And so it's got that classic shoreline salt marsh kind of vibe. And then my sort of second favorite, if you will, in terms of atmosphere, is Hopkins Vineyard in Warren. So way the heck in the other corner, and that's on Lake Werramog, which if you've never been to Lake Werramog, just go in summer or fall. Even if you just drive around the lake, it's just jaw-droppingly gorgeous. But yeah, the vineyards kind of range from semi-luxurious setting all the way down to super rustic, almost like it's in a house. There's kind of something for everyone, I think.
I was looking around the Department of Agriculture website and they list them, and they don't give you the beautiful sort of glossy view that their individual websites do, but it's a nice overview if you're trying to figure out which ones allow you to bring in outside food or which ones do the private events, so you know which ones to go to or avoid, whatever you're looking for.
You have to check really the individual websites for hours and things like that, but the CT Wine website will give you kind of a background of the trail. I thought it was amusing that they said no matter where you are in Connecticut, there are one or more wineries open for visitors within a 45-minute drive. And I just thought, you know, hashtag steady habits, like, gotta have your wine. But actually, I didn't realize that commercial wineries were not allowed in the state until 1978, I believe. So, which seems quite late to me for a state with, you know, grapes on our flag. Like, clearly this has been going on for longer than that, but I guess it would be considered a relatively young wine industry compared to someplace like California.
Something else I saw is that they have a winter wine trail.
Yes, this is a year-round activity, yeah. Right, which is important to remember because I think we're going to talk a little bit about fall activities in a minute, but I think so many people kind of get into a mindset where beaches are for summer and vineyards are for summer or maybe fall and gardens are for spring. Well, I suppose gardens really are for spring. But, you know, they kind of, when thinking about what to do, forget that off-season activities can be sometimes even more of a special experience. And yes, a number of wineries are open in winter.
So other fun fact I found is in 2016, so a little bit dated, but Connecticut produced 160,000 gallons of wine, so 800,000 bottles of wine produced in state.
Nice.
I think I drank two of those. So I guess my favorite two would be the ones I've been to. Like, I have nothing but positive things to say, even though they're very different.
And the other one was Lost Acres, you say?
Right, Lost Acres Vineyard up in North Granby. And mm-hmm. Actually, I'm glad you said about calling them interchange. I don't know if there's a difference between vineyard and wineries, and I didn't think to find out, so I'm just going to call them whatever word comes out of my mouth.
They seem to be used interchangeably in terms of marketing, I will say that.
Right. So North Granby, that area is very, lots of farms, and in between like what looks to be gravel pits in some places on the way up there. And part of what makes it my favorite is because it's like a twofer where there's a really good ice cream place nearby, Grassroots Creamery, so I have to like give them a shout out. I don't know how exactly that pairs with wine, but I've had them in close proximity and they work well.
I don't know if they still are pushing this, but there used to be a Connecticut ice cream trail for a little while. Like there was a chocolate trail, there's a beer trail now.
So this place, they have flavors like goat cheese and sweet plum, honey lavender, blueberry cheesecake, and then like the regular vanilla chocolate kind of stuff. But for me, for going to a place where there's not a lot around there, it makes sense to have something else to do.
Vineyards, actually, I would say all that I've been to, you have options. You can either sit indoors or outdoors with your wine, or you can sort of take your glass and stroll around through the grapevines. It's actually a surprisingly kid-friendly activity. I've seen lots of kids sort of running around on the grass playing, at least during the day. And that's another thing that I, you know, not having kids, I probably would assume that would not be a kid-friendly environment at a wine tasting kind of place, but it totally is. People of all ages, really.
You know, I do like that there's a variety of experiences you can have there. You can do the tasting or not do the tasting.
Exactly. And you can go all in and do the guided tour and things, which of course you'd have to find out about the times and days that's offered at an individual winery. Pretty much all of them will have red and white, although we were discussing earlier, we think that Connecticut tends to produce more white wine than red. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are also some vineyards that do fruit wine. That's actually one of the ones on my list of vineyards I want to go to at some point. What is it called? Homburg Orchard? in Gales Ferry. I've been there. They have like a little farm store stand that's super cute, and I've been to that. But they also do tastings, and they produce fruit wine, which I've never been able to get into, but I want to like it because I like fruit. So, I like fruit. I like wine. Why don't I like this? So I'm thinking a tasting of that might be, an interesting thing to experience. And that's not the only vineyard that does fruit wines. It's also not the only vineyard that's combined with a store. At least one I can think of, which is Bishop's Orchard in Guildford, that has like quite a large, almost like a grocery store, really, a farm market, like quite a large farm market where you can get anything from regular produce to prepared food to just all sorts of things. And then in the back, they have this little, they sell a nice selection of bottles of wine from different Connecticut vineyards, but they also do tastings and things like that.
One of the things I've been most surprised about is that it's not snobby like I expected it to be, where you have to go in and, I don't know, gargle the wine or something, and talk about the nose of it. And when I have done the tastings, it's someone kind of asked, like, would you like to have that information? And I was like, no, I just want to taste it to see which one I want a glass of or a bottle of, because I'll know, and I don't have all the vocabulary for it, but I'll know if I like it or not. So at least where I've been so far, it hasn't had that sort of exclusive impression that you have to come in with all this knowledge.
And I've done a bunch of tastings where I have listened to the whole little story about each wine and the grapes and the process. And even though I don't fully understand what they're saying, it's very chill. It's not some kind of lecture, and you are not expected to know anything about wines.
There's a Geological Society of Connecticut, and they have produced a little book from a field trip that they've done. I think they've taken this a few times. And they talk about growing grapes and, producing wine in Connecticut, but through the lens of geologists. So instead of just talking about something having a flinty taste or earthy, they go really deep into this, the bedrock.
I feel like if you start to research anything in Connecticut deeply enough, you get to like plate tectonics pretty quickly, because no pun intended with deeply, but you get to it, because I just think our terrain makes so much of the state kind of weird, and then that's where you find the explanation of how we got to be like this. You can get super deep or you can get super shallow, which is what I like about when I was reading the CT Wine website prior to recording this, and I guess in defense against people who would say that Connecticut couldn't possibly produce grapes for wine, they said Connecticut is surprisingly mild. So, just in case you say that we need to be someplace hot to do this, we're surprisingly mild, guys. We can do it. And the wine is good.
So one of the things that I've seen, if you pay attention to social media, is the prevalence of bridal showers in the lake at these vineyards. And in your experience, like, what are the odds of accidentally running into one of those? Or can you avoid it if you don't want to be part of somebody's special day?
I've actually never encountered a bridal shower. I have seen a few proposals, but...
Well, there's wine involved, I guess.
Right. And good backdrop for the gram and all that. Obviously, there are a lot of weddings booked at vineyards, and once you go to one, you can completely understand why somebody would want to have their wedding there. It shouldn't, maybe I'm naive, but I've avoided bridal showers thus far. There's probably if you go during the week, that'll probably get you a little bit safer, right? During the week, during the day, if you can manage it. Maybe the trick is looking at the other direction and seeing what is the most popular day and time to have a shower. Or do you mean a shower or a bachelorette party?
Shower. Oh, really? Okay. But I kind of blend the two.
Okay. Yeah, no, I wouldn't really want to encounter either one, but I think a shower would be more sedate. and a bachelorette party would be... Although, maybe that wouldn't happen around here so much, because it's not a crazy vibe at all. It's not like a crazy drunken vibe.
No.
So, yeah. I think you could probably... And most of them are so large that if there was a shower or a party or something going on, you could probably just go around and find your own area.
That's something else I noticed as like a misconception I had, was expecting people to be fall down drunk because of tasting wine all day, but it is pretty chill.
Yeah, it's not like Sideways. Remember that movie? It's not like that. I mean, I'm sure there are people who do whatever, but yeah, it's a pretty, it's not fancy, but it's a pretty classy activity. It's not a place you go to get drunk, I don't think.
Kind of expensive for that.
Right, and they're all pretty much out in the country, so you have to drive there, so I would just really hope that people are not getting drunk before leaving, right. Please.
Although, where we were just now, you could see and hear the train, you just can't get to the train, so
right.
That nice safe option.
You could, in theory, take a train and then get a cab if you planned it right. Really correctly, yeah.
So one of the things we were talking about at Saltwater Farm was it's what its origins were?
Yeah, so I knew this, but I didn't remember when I suggested that Carrie and I go there today as very serious research for this podcast, that it was actually really fitting because it has a travel theme in that it was a World War II era airport, and the building in which they now do the wine tastings was an airplane hangar. And it's obviously been renovated and it looks very nice and shiny, but it still does retain that kind of airplane hangar look. It's like a little bit industrial, I guess you would say, in this very lush kind of setting, which is part of why it's one of my favorite wineries. So, you know, very travel-y.
Yeah.
If you like the travel theme.
I love that I wasn't sure pulling in there, that I was, there was a sign, but it wasn't really clear. And I'm like, maybe I'm going the right direction, maybe I'm not. This is a long, gravelly road. It's really pretty wherever I'm going.
Much like driving to the actual airport today, you're not sure if you're going on the right road.
So, yes, good job for keeping that a realistic part of the experience. As you were saying, there are some activities that are specific to times of year. This one doesn't have to be, but we are now, as of last night, officially in fall.
That's right. And I just looked this morning and saw that there are 89 days of fall left. So pressure's on, I guess.
It really is. And it feels like it, which is nice to feel like it's within the right season. And even though there's some adjustments that have to be made. Is there anything special that you're thinking of doing in the next few weeks?
Well, fall is, I think in some ways it's the best time to do so much in Connecticut because you can pretty much do anything except skiing. And I was going to say swimming, but some people keep on swimming throughout the year. So this is like my soapbox that I always get on every year. And I've probably talked about it here too, but fall is the best time to go to the beach. Because they're all free, nearly all. They are all deserted because, again, most people get in that mindset of beach is for summer. The weather is perfect. You're not going to get too sweaty. You're not going to get too cold. That kind of extends beyond beaches to really anything that you might do outdoors, like from outdoor dining to picnics to, I don't know, going to the Bridgeport Zoo or going shopping in an open air style shopping mall, anything where you might spend a considerable amount of time outdoors, this is a great time to do it without getting too hot, without having to be covered in sunscreen, you know, and it's just the views, what with the foliage, which has not started yet, but, you know, don't discount like traditionally summer activities because it's fall. It's obviously a great time for hiking. And it's a great time for all those traditional fall things like, you know, farm stands and farmers markets are at their best this time of year. You've got pumpkins, you've got corn, you've got apples, you've got a lot of little local festivals with fall themes, haunted stuff if you're into that. This is obviously the season for that. apple cider, cider donuts, cider mills, sugar shacks, anything like that. It's like traditional fall. And since people come from around the country and around the world to New England just to experience fall, you might as well try to get into it a little bit.
We have Nightfall coming up in Hartford in a couple of weeks. The giant puppet seasonal theatrical thing that I can never really describe, but it's free and it's kind of made to be all ages. We've got Cedar Hill Cemetery in Hartford has its, I didn't think the name, but Haunted Lantern Tour, basically reenactments of the lives of different people who are buried in Cedar Hill Cemetery. So around Halloween, kind of creepy. You get to be in a graveyard at night.
And there are a lot of those, if you're not near Hartford, there are a lot of haunted lantern cemetery tour events, yeah. You know, and Google like your town. I would say CT Visit, or is it Visit CT? No, it's CT Visit. We'll link to the state tourism website. They have a good list of events, and even look by month or by day or by region. They have a good list of fall events, but I would also say just Google your town calendar, because I've done this, so it's hard, and you do this like every month and you know it's really hard, but it's almost impossible to create a cohesive statewide, or even for one city, it's hard to create a calendar of all the stuff that's going on, because it's just, there's so much and we're so fragmented that it's really hard to get all the events in one place. So if you see a list of like Connecticut fall events, don't assume that it's comprehensive at all.
Right. Absolutely.
Really check for where you live and the exact weekend or whatever that you're interested in, because there's probably something going on. One thing that I plan to do is I try every year to go to a different agricultural fair. So this year, I'm kind of interested in going to the last fair of the season, which there's actually two. And I don't know when this episode is going to go up, but if you're listening and it is before the first weekend in October, the Portland Fair and the Harwinton Fair are going on that weekend. And I've never gone to one that late in the season, so I think that might be interesting to see.
I've been to the Portland Fair, mm-hmm. and I have a sweatshirt from there, and I'm not usually a buy shirt stuff, so was a lot colder than I was expecting it to be that day.
Do you recommend the Portland Fair?
I liked it. I haven't been to the Harwinton Fair, but I've been to the fairgrounds for other things. I like the Woodstock Fair better.
Right.
It felt like it had a lot more. I haven't been to the Hebron Fair in years. I haven't, like the other ones that are about the size. I went to the Berlin Fair probably 15 years ago, and it didn't leave much of an impression one way or the other. So but Portland, it's at least in a rural area where it's plausible that there's fair stuff.
Portland and Harwinton are both pretty rural. Obviously, the Durham Fair is the big one, and that's already passed, and that's quite big. I mean, it's a little bit much. You can go through it and not see nearly all of it. So I'm fine with a smaller fair. And I just read that the foliage is going to be late this year. I don't know. I think it was last year too. And that's always a little bit risky, just because there's that chance we could get a storm that knocks all the leaves off the trees before they get a chance to change. But I am planning on doing a little bit of traveling around the state and looking for places with good foliage.
There were a few places I saw within the last month when I had gone riding my bike different places, and I was like, it was really hot and I was miserable, and looking around going, well, I'll appreciate this if, you know, it's about 40 degrees cooler and there are leaves looking really pretty. There are a few spots to revisit, and I had just gone up the Farmington Canal Trail part of that, and didn't realize the history of it. I just thought it was some random name. And that's another spot I definitely want to hit because of the way, and I'm thinking more so up in the Granby area where you're just suddenly going through woods. And I was like, wow, that's going to look stunning. So hopefully it'll be late, but not a disaster.
Yes, let's hope. Another trail like that that's good for foliage is the Canal Trail in Windsor. It's a state Park, I believe. And you're basically walking on this track in between the river and a canal. So you've got water on either sides and just lots of trees. So that's anything like that. I'm trying to think of other foliage spots. The reservoirs in West Hartford are always good for that. But really, you don't have to necessarily go to the places that are touted as the best foliage. You can really find it anywhere.
Right. I tend to look for avoiding the crowds a little bit.
Right.
So that I can gawk at the leaves and not be like in somebody's way.
Right. And rural areas are always good, so you can stop and take a picture without endangering yourself.
So it is a cliche, but I do like apple picking and going to the orchards. The one in South Glastonbury, I don't know if it's the closest to me, but I have an affinity for it.
Do you actually pick apples, or do you just go? I just go and buy the bag of apples that they've already picked.
No, I pick them. I wish that they didn't make you get on the tractor or they pull you around, because I'd rather just walk all over the place. But I do pick the apples and have to limit myself. Something I want to try differently this year is to get there, ride my bike to Rocky Hill, and then take the ferry over to Glastonbury and ride over there. It's doable, maybe a little ambitious for me, especially maybe more so on the way back, but that'll limit how many apples that I can pick because I have to carry them.
But it's a very good transition to our next segment, and we're going to talk about fairies. Fairies with an E, not fairies that fly around. you mentioned the Glastonbury Rocky Hill ferry, and I have not yet been on that one, but I have been on its little twin ferry, I guess, the Chester Hadlime ferry. If you live in Connecticut and you haven't done one or both of these, I would say it's a must-do. There's nothing else like it. And if you haven't done it, you might be thinking, it's a car ferry. Like, why would I do that if I didn't need to? But these are basically 250-year-old traditions that have been going on continually in Connecticut, and going on for longer than that, too. People had to get across the river somehow. And it's just a very sweet, kind of unspoiled. You drive onto this tiny ferry. There's only room for a handful of cars. Takes like 3 minutes to get across the river. The views are absolutely stunning. The Chester Hadlime ferry takes you right under Gillette Castle, and you just get the whole views of the Connecticut River, and you feel like you're taking part in this historic river crossing. It feels much grander than a 2-minute trip on a tiny car ferry should. And by the way, depending on where you're going, it can save you hours of driving.
Right. But it is a very cheap way to get I think of it as like a poor man's river cruise.
It is. It's like a little tiny boat tour.
It's the Rocky Hill one. It's like $2 if you're walking or bringing your bike on. So you could even just drive up to the park
and get walk on.
And then just go back and forth. And
even in a car, it's something like $4 or $5 a vehicle, and it's per vehicle, not per person. So I don't know, take all your friends, whatever. But yeah, it's not expensive, and you do get a little boat tour.
But you know, as you were saying, there's possibility for some glitches. So bad weather, if the water levels are too high, they won't run it. The Rocky Hill one, they said they're closed on Mondays for the time being because of staffing issues. I know several people who they've gone down there riding their bikes, and they get there, and because they didn't look ahead, they get there and they realize it's closed, and that's a bit more work to turn around and go back another direction.
Yeah.
So I would say
check
their website, call or whatever to see if they're running that day. So
and we'll link to that too. And that's the Connecticut Department of Transportation,
right,
that runs it. So
it's public transportation. It's like a continuation of a route.
Right.
We were talking about closing the one in Rocky Hill a few years ago. That was one of the arguments, was this is part of one of your state routes. You have to have service that goes across the river.
Right. And they do periodically threaten to close it for budgetary reasons, and people always protest because I think partly for convenience of transportation or necessity of transportation, and also because it's just such a Connecticut institution.
Yeah, so what's the weirdest ferry that you've been on?
That I've been on? I haven't personally been on any weird ones. The most fun one I've been on, which is a little bit like what we were just talking about, except quite different experience, is the Charlestown Ferry in Boston. And I say similar because it's run by the MBTA. So it's basically like taking the T, except it's a boat. And it goes from the Charlestown Navy Yard over to right by the Boston Aquarium, or the New England Aquarium, whatever, the aquarium in Boston. It's a quick trip, but you get great views. It's almost like a little harbor tour. When I've taken it, people have been in a really good mood, which you're not going to get on the T. Mm-hmm. Granted, I haven't taken it at 8 o'clock on a Monday morning when people are commuting on it. Maybe it's a little different. But it's a fun experience, and it's a, you know, just a fun form of public transportation that you don't think about when you think of the bus or the subway or the commuter rail. And of course, Boston, there are a lot of other ferries out of there to the Harbor Islands and things like that that I have not taken that are on my list. I've been planning on going to the Boston Harbor Islands for a long time. Haven't made it. But I think another thing that we tend to forget is just how many places in New England are serviced by ferry. I mean, you can take one from Providence to Newport. Obviously from New London, where I live, you can get to Block Island. Mm-hmm. You can get to Long Island. If you live in the western part of the state, you can take the ferry from Bridgeport to Long Island. You know, you can take the ferry from Rhode Island to Block Island, which is, I'm from Point Judith, Rhode Island to Block Island, Rhode Island. So there's lots of options. Like if you don't want to drive, you can't drive to Block Island anyway. So, yeah. But there's a lot of options if you don't want to drive to Long Island, or, you know, if you don't want to drive out of your way to reach a bridge. So it's a thing to keep in mind, I think. Do you have a weird ferry?
I have only other people's stories.
Okay.
So I've heard two things which are similar, and it was experiences from people with bicycles. And one was involving the Long Island ferry. Actually, where was that too? I think one was to Fisher's Island.
Oh, yeah.
So that... one of them, but it was like the cost of... to Fisher's Island, the rates were really confusing, and I was just looking at the website trying to understand it, and it was... like, the regular rates, you have bicycles not listed. But then it was listed under commuter rate. And that rate was almost the same, I want to say, as a car. So that seems really strange. And I feel like there's information that's not given. But maybe they have a different rate. It just seems strange because you can take, you know, a car spot. You could fit, like, five. You could fit more. But, like, five bicycles in that spot. And it feels like if you charge a little bit less. But, you know, you can make that worth your while without charging like the same amount or more. So
there's a lot about Fisher's Island, I feel, that's a little, they're withholding information. It's a slightly mysterious place, even though it's right over there. I could, you know, probably see it on a clear day, I feel like. And there is a ferry from right downtown New London that goes there.
Right.
But yeah, that doesn't really surprise me that they're vague about their fares.
No, and the other one was taking, again, not my experience, because I've had no trouble when I've taken the ferry to Long Island. But a friend was taking his bike there and it locked it up and then went up to, you know, where you get out of your car and you go and you sit somewhere on the ferry, right? So did the same kind of thing and got called over the loudspeaker over the intercom. It was like, you know, person who has whatever bicycle locked to this thing, you need to go back to it. And got hassled because they wanted him to stay with his bike. And he was like, but why? Like, you can leave your car and you can see what's on my bike. And it had a bike loaded up for, like, riding, so it was, like, 100 pounds, like, all in. It's not like you could easily move it. And they caused this, like, big fuss about it. And it was like, you know, people can have explosives in their car trunks and you would never know. But you can look and see what's on the bicycle. So I think finally probably acquiesced. Then did whatever in Long Island. Then coming back, so that was going from Bridgeport to Long Island. On the way back, went the other end and came back to New London. They couldn't care on that one. They were like, whatever. So I would say, like, maybe be aware that if you're going in a way that doesn't involve a car, that you might have a strange experience with someone who doesn't understand different modes of transportation, or they just have wacky policies, maybe.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't have any experience with the bike route. Obviously, I've only driven my car or just gone on as a pedestrian. But I bet you know people that have done this crazy thing in Vermont, which I've seen pictures of it, and it's terrifying. It's the Colchester Causeway bike path, and it is basically an old railroad track that goes from Colchester, Vermont, across to, I don't know which town, across Lake Champlain. So right through the middle of the lake, it's about, I don't know, it's miles and miles and miles. I don't think you could walk it. You could if you really were into that, I guess. But yeah, it's definitely primarily a bike trail. But the thing is, in the middle of the lake, it just cuts off. It stops. And the two halves of this causeway are linked up by a tiny little bike ferry that goes in between the two.
So offhand, I don't remember anyone telling me about that, but I would put money on that at least one person I know has done that.
Yeah. But if you want to see this thing, go to Instagram or Google Image or any image search and just look for Colchester Causeway Bike Path, because it is slightly terrifying. Probably no good segue from 250-year-old bridges to smartphones and apps and technology and travel, but we also wanted to talk about how technology affects the experience of travel, positives, negatives. I think most people would agree that there are both.
According to Expedia, the average person spends 9 hours of a week-long vacation on social media, which... It's just a couple years old, so it's not going to be even like that outdated.
If you don't post your vacation on social media, did you even go on vacation?
Right, and how much of that is even just the posting that, and how much of that is getting caught up in all kinds of other elements of social media? Is this any different than like going into a motel and turning on the TV when you're on vacation, or being a workaholic? But it is different.
I think it feels different. And that's one I hadn't even thought of, but absolutely it can suck your time if you're prone to that. The obvious positive is the ability to stay in touch with either your family at home when you're traveling, or people that you're meeting on the way, or just anybody that you need to contact. Just the ability to like do research on the road, get maps, get information, make hotel reservations or cancel them, or you know, find out if your flight is late or anything like that. I think that's quite obviously the big advantage, and that's why traveling now does feel very different from 20 years ago.
Yeah, and something I didn't benefit from this directly, but I was following the East Coast Greenway Instagram account, and just happened, this pops up that this guy, who I have no idea who he is, they're congratulating him or whatever because he had just finished going south-north on the Appalachian Trail, hiking that, and then when he got to Maine, decided he was going to turn around and go south on the East Coast Greenway, so biking, which is, all of that is very, very impressive. And I was like, whoa, I've got to check this out and follow him. And by doing that, I was able to find out that he was just about in the Hartford area, so I reached out and was like, hey, do you have a place to stay when you come through? I ended up meeting him and getting to hear about his story. He had a place to stay, and so I thought that was a real benefit.
That's definitely something that I've experienced too, not as like interesting as that, but just getting in contact with people all around the world and all around the country and getting to know them online, and then having this opportunity when you're traveling to meet up with them or stay with them or just get information from them, even local information. That is a huge benefit of social media. I think my big downside to it is the way, and for me, this is Instagram especially, although I love it too, but there's this feeling I get now that you almost can't feel like you're discovering a place for yourself anymore because everything is so photographed and so shared. There's virtually no place on earth that you can't look it up on Instagram and see pictures of it. I mean, from North Korea to just anywhere almost. If you do manage to find a place, and there's like no posts from there on Instagram. I guess that's how you know these days that you found someplace that's like less traveled. But I do feel like it kind of takes something away from travel, and not just in that pretentious way of like, oh, I discovered, you know, it's like, okay, you know you didn't discover it, but it takes something away from the way people experience traveling and the way people share. I mean, I don't want to blame Instagram for the decline of travel writing. There's many, many other factors. But I do think that people have no interest in reading any deeper accounts of a place now because they think they know all about that place because they've seen 80,000 photographs of it, and they know all the restaurants that are there, and they know all the trendy coffee bars that are there. So what could they possibly have to read about, like, its history and its, you know, and some other person's experience? The experience of someone else as a traveler is kind of cheapened when anybody can post that stuff online. The expertise to it is no longer there.
I get so excited when I try to tag something on Instagram and nothing's coming up.
Right, it's like, create a tag.
And I was like, no, I'm not going to create a tag. I might put a hashtag there, but I'm not. I'm going to leave it the way it is. But you're absolutely right. And I think that, like, I love Instagram because you get all the visuals and it's great for trying to figure out where might I go some other time.
It's great for inspiration and research and even like armchair travel. Like, I use it that way too.
But I think it's, there are some people I follow who stand out because they actually give you some context for what they're looking at, or, you know, why they're there. Why was this place important to them to take a picture of? And it's not that many people who give you that context.
And when you see that, keep in mind that if it's not somebody that you know personally, if someone is taking the time to write those captions, either it's a passion or it's they're doing that because it's their job and someone is paying them to do it, which can always affect the quality or the bias of the content.
Right.
So you have to kind of, it's a thing you have to be careful about, which you didn't used to.
Right. I think documentation is important. I mean, I do that all the time. It's a way to, you know, just for yourself, figure out where was I at this point in time.
Yeah, and if you have a bad memory like I do, it's great because there are things without social media and digital photography, I wouldn't be able to place myself for much of my life if I didn't have that.
But yeah, it's the over-documentation or over-saturation. I get bothered by oversharing, like navel-gazing egos or something. Not even selfies, but I'm just gonna be very casual about bragging about where I've been. And in a way where you're like, why are you, I guess that's the question I often have, like, why are you sharing this? And why would this audience, is it to rub it in everyone's face? Or are you just celebrating because you don't get to ever go anywhere and you're really excited about that? Cool. Versus, you know, I saw something, an article online that was to basically talk about this, where you have like the casual first class like photo that's not obviously like taken in first class, but they're trying to show like, hey, look at where I am.
Oh yeah, the bragging, which again, I'm sure it's always gone on, but it's gone on at private parties and
where you have to watch someone's slideshow.
So right,
it's more obvious.
And if you're not friends with the kind of people that would do that, you're not going to see it. Whereas now you can't avoid seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, I wonder about some of those people. Could they have handled traveling the way it was 20 years ago? Or are they free to do it now because it's also easy and it's all right there for them? Because I just think about, you know, paper maps.
Mm-hmm.
I use them occasionally, but I'm very much tempted to rely on my phone. It's sometimes so much easier, even though sometimes the quality of the directions or the map is not as good as figuring it out yourself on a proper map. But I mean, remember like asking for directions when you had to stop your car in some little town in the middle of nowhere and go into some creepy restaurant and ask some creepy people for directions, and you know, and then you had to like remember them or giving directions. Sometimes people ask me for directions. It always happens to me in New York for some reason. Like, people just always stop me on the streets of Manhattan and ask me directions, and I'm so bad at it now. And I think it's because I just rely on my phone. to like tell me how to walk 6 blocks, you know?
Yeah, I spent all morning second guessing myself and making wrong turns, and I blame if I had just left the phone off, I would have found my way.
Right, you get dependent on it. I mean, even when I said before that it's such a plus to be able to call people at home or to call who you're meeting, but I also think it makes me worry a bit more, because if I'm supposed to be in touch with someone and I haven't heard from them, or I can't reach them, or if my phone battery dies and I can't call to say my train is late, I get so worried, like, are they gonna just go home and leave without me? Are they gonna think I died? Like, I get so worried about it. Whereas when I was, you know, in college, taking the train home, if the train was late, I would think, well, okay, my dad will just sit at the station and wait for me. It was like not a big deal.
Yeah, I feel like I'm a real Luddite about making plans, because I feel firmly like you make your plans and you don't change them. And then if there is the emergency that comes up, that's when you find the payphone and you call. And I haven't really adjusted to, you know, you make plans and then people like seem to like frivolously change them at the last
so
minute.
True.
And have to,
yeah.
But I know people do, so I feel like I have to check in.
I think there's almost a bunch of life skills and social skills that are being lost. And it's funny for me to say that because I'm pretty antisocial, but like
patience
and just figuring things out in your own mind without being able to search for a bunch of different kinds of information, navigating yourself out of being lost, asking directions, again, remembering directions, noticing the environment around you. And when I think about the fact that I used to do all that stuff and I was much younger, so I had much less experience of the world then and was far less equipped to handle things going wrong, but I was never really afraid. And now I'm pretty much afraid of everything, as we've discussed before.
Right. I was thinking about one of the first times I went for, you know, drove a pretty long distance, and I think I had written down directions on paper, looked it up on a map in advance, and I had that, and I had like the phone number and of the person and that I was going to meet, and so assumed and found a payphone in a snowstorm and called, and like I didn't get lost and I was fine and I didn't worry.
The best thing you might have would be one of those triptychs from AAA.
Yes.
Which are not very detailed.
No.
I was always okay, and now when I drive into an area with no cell service and I see those little bars go away, I feel like I'm some like lone explorer who's been trapped in the wilderness with no food for like 6 days, and that's just, it's irrational, and it's just all from this dependency on technology that I didn't even grow up with. So think of how it must be for people who are younger.
Yeah, I think we're losing how to live in the moment, and that's, for me, a lot of travel is like immersion in the moment and trying to pay attention to that. So while documentation is good, I'm like, if you do it too much, you're not thinking about you're not looking at what's right in front of you.
Right. Case in point, all those people who fall into canyons and off of waterfalls trying to get perfect photos.
Yeah, I shouldn't laugh.
But it is
to their families, but it is kind of funny.
Or all the times your GPS tells you to turn down, and we've talked about this too, when there are bad decisions, like a dirt road or, you know, off a pier, and you're like, okay, you know.
This can't be right, but I'll do it anyway.
Right. That little thing, we're losing that thing that says, this can't be right. I mean, I feel like ultimately I can't light a fire. I can turn up a thermostat, but when the apocalypse comes, it's the people who can light a fire that are going to survive. And it's the same way with like navigating through the woods or, you know, surviving without everything at your fingertips. That's like, we're losing those skills as a society.
So how do you like modulate this? How do you, you know, I don't want to say put the brakes on it, but how do you keep yourself in check with technology and travel?
I don't know. I avoid a lot of it. And then I feel like that's not particularly savvy, and I probably should be using all these tools that we have. But, you know, I've never taken Uber or Lyft because the rating system makes me outraged and angry. I don't like the thought that I could find it harder to get a cab ride, essentially, because some like 22-year-old kid driving a car gives me one star because I'm not like young and hot, you know, that just like drives me like, and someday I'll probably break down and use it. But, you know, I don't use like a ton of hacks for flights. Like I'll monitor them a little bit, but I basically just buy the flight when it's convenient, and when it's not crazy expensive, I won't use like all the, there's all kinds of apps for like absolutely gaming the hell out of like getting the cheapest flight. I don't do that. I do use the maps, but I try to at least look at real maps beforehand, so I have some idea of where I'm going if possible, and I'm not entirely dependent on my phone. But yeah, I don't know that I have a good balance, really.
Something else I've been doing is trying to use my camera more than my phone, because once the phone comes out, then I'm like, well, let's see what's on Facebook, you know? And then it becomes a spiral. And I say, well, I take better pictures with the camera anyway, and I'm not distracting myself.
I guess one thing that you can do, I've never done this, but I know people who do, which is quite simple, although it can be really difficult depending on your personality, I guess, is just do the whole digital detox while you're traveling. You know, like you can delete, I don't have Facebook on my phone, but I could delete Instagram and Twitter and all of that from my phone and use it purely for, you know, emergencies and information. That's always an option if you want to do that.
Well, I think for some people it really is a struggle and like an addiction.
Yeah.
And you can also pick places where they're going to have limited or no Wi-Fi. A few weeks ago, I was in Virginia for a friend's wedding, and I knew in advance that it was going to be pretty spotty Wi-Fi there, which made me nervous because I was going to be hiking around a lot, and I thought, well, if something happens, how do I reach anybody? But I also, in advance, let people know, not everybody, but I let people know, I'm going to be somewhere you can't reach me probably for a couple of days, so don't panic if you don't hear back. And that gave me permission to also not, like, in the places where I did have Wi-Fi, I basically looked in my mail to see if I had heard anything from my mother, because that's like, you know, see if there's any emergencies in the family. And aside from that, as I'll say, people know I can't be reached. I'm not going to bother. So I thought that was really helpful for me.
And you weren't alone on that trip either,
I wasn't
right?
alone. Like, and it was Shenandoah. I mean, I wasn't deep into the Appalachian Trail. It was in a pretty populated area. Like, people would have come across me eventually, as long as I didn't fall way down into a ditch somewhere.
But I do think if you have traveling companions, I think that's one thing too, like, is limiting the social media aspect of it, at least to have more, like, just have a good time with the people you're traveling with. Whereas when you're alone, it's definitely still a balance, because I could imagine it kind of luring you into, like, not being so adventurous, because you have this other option, which is to, like, stay in your hotel and watch YouTube or whatever. But it can also be, I think you can sort of feel internally if it's, like, a positive thing to be using technology or not. Like, I know that to a certain extent, when I'm traveling alone, just being able to contact people, and it doesn't have to be long conversations or anything time consuming, but just as like, I'm in this town, I'm going to this other town, just so knowing that somebody knows where I am on the earth is comforting. Safety is like a huge plus that I don't think we mentioned yet, but obviously just letting people know where you are, being able to call for help, assuming you're not in one of those areas with no service, even little things like being able to sit there and look busy with your phone when some annoying person is trying to talk to you.
Right.
All of those things can be, very helpful.
The faked phone call.
Absolutely. Walking home in the dark with the fake phone call. Yeah.
I've only done that once. Actually, the funny thing was I was on a real phone call. This was just like daylight walking home from work. And some random stranger interrupted me to like convert me to Jesus or something. And I kind of went off on him because I was like, how dare you interrupt my phone call?
Jesus would not have interrupted my phone call.
Right? Usually that works, but some people also don't get those social cues of like person actively talking on their phone. Maybe don't have a conversation with them unless it's like, I'm bleeding out, can you help? I think there's ways to use it to be more mindful. Now we're talking about using it as a way to be more safe. I've heard the criticism that putting all your pictures on Facebook and Instagram as a way to advertise that you're gone and getting house wrapped. Is there any actual truth to that? Like, I kind of get that if you overannounce where you are, that could happen in some universe, but do thieves prowl Facebook to find that information?
I personally have only heard of that happening to people that have quite a large platform, like celebrities or big-time bloggers, and who are, like, quite wealthy. So the stuff that they're advertising in their home is, you know, closets full of designer bags and jewelry and so on. I've never heard of it happening to a regular person. That doesn't mean that it, you know, hasn't, but I do kind of think about that. I don't do anything about it. I don't refrain from posting while I'm away, but I will usually not post while I'm at a certain place, which is maybe not so much about safety, but just introvert, antisocial, don't happen to come up to me while I'm here behavior. I don't know. I like to leave a little lag time, so I'm not literally broadcasting where I am at every moment.
And I guess that's the other advantage of using, like, you know, having the camera instead of just doing everything on the phone for pictures, is that it does have that built-in buffer between, you know, I need to go hook the camera up to the computer, get the photos off, then go and put them up if I'm going to do that. And it builds in that time between, like, when I was somewhere and when they're being posted.
See, this is a perfect example of how I don't use the technology to the extent that it can be used because I'm inept. It's supposedly so easy to connect your camera to your phone through Wi-Fi, and I can never get mine to connect. Like, I try it, it doesn't work. I try. So there's...
I have no idea. I don't think mine does that.
There's a step. There, you know, if I'm going to post photos from the camera onto the phone, I have to get the little SD card reader and plug it into the... There's, like, a little step that prevents me from posting directly. And I would prefer it not be there in that case. But yeah, it's really more my own sort of reluctance and I guess just my own... remembrance of back in the day, you know.
Right.
I used to phone people from the little phone on board the Metro North train. Collect.
I used to have to wait for my phone to be developed.
You're right. Take your phone to CVS. Yeah, exactly.
Something I did notice that was disturbing to me. I know that photos get manipulated. I know that. But, and like I said, a lot of what I have on Instagram, if you can tell, by the quality of it, usually if it's like a quick picture of a silly sign, I'm just taking out my phone. But, you know, if it's vertical, I just plug in my camera because I've taken the time to actually compose the photo, whatever. There's some travel bloggers, or kind of, I don't want to say travel, but like lifestyle.
Right.
Instagrammers, bloggers.
Yeah.
Who I found, they'll have these gorgeous, stunning photos. And then I've seen behind the scenes things where they have pictures of themselves and they've basically photoshopped them. So they've been to the actual place, but then they photoshopped themselves in.
Oh, yeah.
After, and they
a lot of those
really
are
bothered me.
Really manipulated. It's almost to the point where it's some sort of, like, it's art, I guess, if you
right.
consider that type of, like, photo, what is that called? There's a name for it. It's photography, and it's art. It's like, well, it's escaping me now. But yeah, the problem is that they don't tell you that that's what they're doing. And that, I think, especially for younger people probably, is, like, it creates this sort of travel envy in a way that was previously sort of restricted to, like, airbrushed images of, like, women in magazines. And if you didn't know, you know, you'd have that image of, like, oh, I'm supposed to be, like, my waist is supposed to be, like, you know, 19 inches around or whatever. And but now that's for, like... every aspect of life, including traveling.
This person just hiked up a mountain, or like not a mountain, but like, you know, did this hike where most people be a little bit sweaty, a little, you know, hair is going different places, and she looks fabulous.
Full
and,
makeup and heels.
Yeah.
Or right. Like, how can this person afford to go to all these places? And you know, yeah.
You're like, yes, she really looks like that, and yes, she really was there, and but that she was not there looking like that that day. She was sweaty and gross like the rest of us, but we would never know that.
Right, and I'm not... I don't know how professional photographers think of this, but I would imagine that, you know, you can do so much with filters, and I'm very grateful for that, but you could also make a pretty, you know, if you're skilled at it, a really drab place look, like, amazing. And I just wonder, when the point of that is advertising, like when those people do get to that place and discover that it doesn't look like this, what do they think? I don't know. You know, maybe yeah. someday there will be like a long form essay about disappointed travelers lured in by.
Well, I feel like we should have that impression based on like people take pictures of their food, which sometimes mm-hmm. I'll do that. And people who are trained can take pictures that make everything look amazing and appetizing. And I'll be like, that lobster roll looks good, even though that's something I would never touch.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people who just don't get the concept of lighting and everything looks like vomit. And
it's
got like a
yeah.
green hue to it. And you're like, please stop doing that. I'm sure you're a good cook, but yikes. So I feel like we should have a better understanding, at least when it comes to food, because of that.
And there's something that changes, I think. There were always images in Condé Nast Traveler and Food and Wine and in every magazine for every aspect of lifestyle. But you knew, most people kind of knew that their house wasn't going to look like Architectural Digest
right.
and their vacation photos were not going to look like Travel and Leisure
mm-hmm.
because you knew that those were the best photographers in the world and, you know, they were paid a lot of money to do that. And when you see it on social media, whether or not you even know that that's the case, you're not like consciously thinking about the fact mm-hmm. that this is essentially an ad campaign or somebody bragging or whatever. You're thinking like, oh, this person's having an experience that I can't have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably damaging in ways that we don't even think about.
Right. And as much as I will use Instagram as that travel inspiration and just the kind of like, I guess, travel porn, just like, well, I'm staring at my office walls today and this place looks nice. Portland, wow, your donuts look wonderful. But I realized this, like, I have a friend who I hadn't seen for a while, and I ran into her recently. She was commenting, like, oh, you've been traveling a lot lately, and I hadn't really thought, I mean, more than usual, but I hadn't really thought about it. And I was like, right, she's only really seeing my life through Instagram, and because I'm mostly not putting up mundane, boring, like, the day-to-day stuff. Occasionally, you'll get something from like, you know, someone I share an office with put some cute decorations up, but I'm usually not putting that information out there. So it does, like, I'm doing the thing that annoys me when others do it.
It's taking something away, I think, from like life experience, whether it's an actual skill like reading a map or whether it's an experience like going to a place you've never seen before,
mm-hmm.
which is so rare now, or whether it's just that little feeling you get when you're like, oh, everybody's life is so nice, you know,
right.
It's like it's stealing something from your life in some way.
Yeah.
If you have any thoughts on positive or negative aspects of tech and travel that we have forgotten, please leave us a comment and let us know.
Shout out to CTMQ Steve, who we are still going to have on the show when we can get all of our schedules to align. Thanks to Patreon supporters, Allison, Anthony, Brian, Constanza, Margot Lynn, Nancy, and Steve.
Thanks for listening to Going Steady. You can now listen on the Apple Podcasts app, iTunes, and Stitcher. If you'd like to rate or review us over there, that would be a great help. You can also subscribe to Going Steady and receive notifications by email. Sign up at goingsteadyct.com. That's goingsteadyct.com. Comments, suggestions for future episodes, hit us up at goingsteadyct.com.